It's the NPR News Update podcast for Friday, May 29. I'm Phil Picardi with the Minnesota News on your schedule. Coming up, cracking a big Indian country drug ring. The Minneapolis mayor sounds off on a new report on arrest disparities in her city. Are base jumpers nuts? And Joe Dowling talks about his final play at the Guthrie. First, federal and tribal law enforcement officials say they took down a five-state trafficking ring that funneled illicit drugs into two Minnesota Indian reservations. Authorities yesterday announced charges against 41 people who are accused of spreading heroin and heartache through the Red Lake and White Earth reservations. Tribal police chiefs called the drug a poison. Laura Ewan has more.
Randy Goodwin has seen the horrific path blazed by heroin and prescription drugs on White Earth, where he's in charge of public safety.
Many lives, families, and communities have been damaged or destroyed from this poison. Lives have been lost from overdose. Families have been destroyed. Our elders have been victims of threats, abuse, and theft.
Goodwin says even newborn babies have come into this world exposed to heroin because of their mother's addictions. And in Red Lake, Public Safety Director Bill Brunell says illegal drug use has reached an epidemic level.
There are many good people living in the Red Lake community who are not addicted to drugs, but nevertheless there are others who have children that are longing for their parents to be drug-free, and unfortunately a percentage of these children take it upon themselves to report their living situation regarding neglect due to illegal drug abuse.
Brunell says making matters worse was a long-standing perception by drug traffickers that Indian country was an easy target given the lack of resources by tribal police. But he says what his department lacks in manpower, it makes up for in collaboration with federal agencies. Here's U.S. Attorney Andy Luger.
To the extent that heroin traffickers believe that their trade will be easier on Indian reservations, I think we're proving today that they're wrong and they need to know it.
In an indictment unsealed this week, prosecutors allege that the traffickers smuggled drugs from Detroit and Chicago and moved them onto the reservations. As of this morning, 35 people had been arrested in places ranging from North Dakota to Gary, Indiana. The alleged ringleader was Omar Sharif Beasley of Minneapolis, a former federal fugitive with a history of drug convictions. Dan Morin is Assistant Special Agent in charge of the U.S. Drug Enforcement Administration in the Twin Cities. He says the group made millions of dollars and had good reason to operate in far-flung corners of the state. As he sees it, the group had a particular business model.
They were trying to do certain things to be able to, one, increase their level of profit on the drugs being sold, two, face less competition based on the regions that they were operating in, and three, really tried to hide the extent of the overall organization by operating in remote portions of this state.
The investigation lasted 7 months. Federal authorities declined to say how they cracked the case. Audrey Thayer, a White Earth member who lives on the Leech Lake Reservation, says she hopes the most recent arrests will put a dent in the amount of drugs that ravage her community. She says her 39-year-old daughter has been using drugs since she was a teenager. Now in treatment, Thayer's daughter has been off of heroin and meth for 7 months.
For families to become healthy, it takes work. And I can only speak on my own behalf in our family. We've worked hard and have had very little success. That gets devastating. And you can see where families give up hope.
Someone who lives on the Red Lake Reservation, contacted by NPR News, wasn't optimistic that the arrests would do much to stop the flow of drugs to the reservation. The source didn't want to be identified because of personal connections to some of the people who were arrested. The source says there are still plenty of dealers around. Law enforcement officials say they're continuing to investigate. With reporting from Dan Gunnarsson and John Anger, I'm Laura Ewan, Minnesota Public Radio News, Minneapolis.
Minneapolis Mayor Betsy Hodges says a new report on Minneapolis arrests is another reminder the city needs to work to eliminate racial disparities. A detailed analysis of Minneapolis police data released by the ACLU found people arrested for non-felony offenses are far more likely to be people of color. Hodges says she's committed to closing the gaps between whites and people of color in Minneapolis Brant Williams reports.
Minneapolis police officers made nearly 100,000 non-felony arrests between January 1st of 2012 and September 30th of 2014. African Americans and Native Americans were arrested at rates nearly nine times higher than the rate for whites. 55-year-old Henry Jackson isn't surprised by that disparity. He's standing across the street from Target Field downtown a few hours before game time with a handful of tickets.
The customers come, I buy off the customers for as cheap as I can and then resell them.
Ticket scalping is legal in Minneapolis. However, Jackson, who is African American, has been arrested for trespassing near here three times since 2012. The latest arrest happened in January outside nearby Target Center as he was selling tickets for a Timberwolves game. He says he stepped inside Target Center to warm his hands when two female police officers cited and released him.
You know, I ain't racist enough, but the white boys, they can do it all day long. But it seemed like they got us signaled out.
An NPR News analysis of the same data the ACLU examined found more than half of people arrested for trespassing are black. African Americans make up nearly 19% of the city's population. Jackson was convicted, ordered to pay a $50 fine, and given a stayed sentence of 90 days in the workhouse on the condition that he stay out of Target Center for a year, which means he can't go in there even if he's a paying customer. The ACLU report comes during a time of intense national discussion about race, police, and inequality. Minnesota ACLU Executive Director Chuck Samuelson sees several reasons for the disparities in Minneapolis arrests. He blames bias on the part of police officers and of people who call police when they see black people who look suspicious. Samuelson says the disparities also come from policies that target enforcement in neighborhoods with large minority populations. But the result is the same.
It's just shameful. We're better than this. We need to be better than this. And there's no reason why we can't be better than this.
Samuelson says the new study is much more detailed than an analysis the ACLU released last fall. That report found Minneapolis had the third highest disparity in the country between the marijuana arrest rates for African Americans and whites. However, it's hard to compare Minneapolis to other cities when looking at all non-felony arrests because ACLU studies in other cities don't contain that data. This report comes on the heels of two studies of police data released recently by the city of Minneapolis. One found that officers rarely record the race of people they detain but don't arrest, and the other found that whites were more likely to call police to report black people suspected of committing non-felony crimes, like loitering. The ACLU study found black children made up the majority of juvenile arrests, and nearly 90% of children between the ages of 4 and 12 arrested for violating curfew were children of color. The data show most people arrested were not booked and jailed. Instead, they were given citations and ordered to go to court.
Welcome to district court. Before your case is called, I'm going to explain your rights to you.
An informational video plays in the lobby outside the courtrooms in the Public Safety Center downtown. The instructions are also broadcast in Spanish, Hmong, and Somali. On a recent Monday morning, dozens of people sat quietly in one courtroom. There are also another dozen or so waiting outside in the lobby. Nearly all of them are people of color.
And usually they're in court for an entire morning.
Assistant Hennepin County Public Defender Melissa Fraser says only a few public defenders and one judge handle the heavy caseload. Fraser says many people choose to plead guilty to the offenses. They've already had to take time off from work or get child care while they wait. And Fraser says fighting a charge will bring more days of waiting in courtrooms. She says pleading guilty may be a faster resolution, but it can mean problems down the road.
If you have a disorderly conduct conviction, that can create problems when you want to rent an apartment or for jobs.
Four of the five top offenses people were arrested for were traffic-related. Driving with a revoked driver's license was the most common reason. NPR News found that nearly three-quarters of people arrested for driving with a revoked license were African-American. Officer Joel Dorn gets in his squad car. Dorn, a third-generation cop, works the middle shift in the 4th Precinct on the city's north side. The ACLU analysis found the disparities for driving offenses were widest during the daytime hours. But Doran, who is white, says officers look for driving violations, not the race of the drivers. And in the early evening sunlight, Doran says it's hard to see who's behind the wheel.
I mean, yeah, take a look at the car in front of us. Can you tell if that's a male or a female, white, black, Asian, you know, native? You can't. You can't tell. I can't tell.
Officers can use in-squad computers to look up registration information on vehicles and view pictures of the car's owners. However, Dorn says often the person in the picture is not the person behind the wheel. The ACLU study also visits the intersection of policing and poverty. The data show police arrested homeless people more than 6,000 times. A man playing a saxophone provides the soundtrack for a sunny spring afternoon on Nicollet Mall. Sergeant Todd Savageau, who supervises the downtown beat patrol, is out walking the mall. He stops to talk to Kevin Holt, who is holding a handwritten sign that says, "Homeless, need your help, thank you."
What's your perception of the officers when they're down here? They treat you pretty well or not so well? And you can be honest, I got nothing to do with the air today. I think you're doing
well.
Fine,
I'm not trying to be negative or anything, you know, but I've been picked on by cops before, you know.
Holt, who is African-American, says he's homeless because he has a criminal record and can't find housing. Holt was arrested for trespassing in 2013 on this same block of Nicollet Mall. Savageau is white and says he understands that some black people have negative feelings about police officers because they've had bad experiences with them. He says officers are trained to look for behaviors that signal criminal activity and are often given descriptions of suspects, which include their race.
We just want to ensure that the mall is a safe place and downtown is a safe place, and the people feel that way about it as well as they walk up and down. So that's kind of what the takeaway is like I said, race doesn't matter to us. We want everyone to be able to enjoy the mall in downtown.
Minneapolis Police Chief Janae Harto says the disparities are not a secret, but she says there are factors behind the numbers. Harto says police presence is higher in areas with more violent crime, and those neighborhoods tend to have large populations of poor people of color.
And so it's not surprising to me that you're going to have lower level offenses at a higher rate in an area where officers are to try to combat violent crime.
Harto says poverty also plays a prominent role in exposing people to the criminal justice system. She says between 2010 and 2014, one in six drivers stopped by Minneapolis police did not have a driver's license. Harto says one reason is that behind-the-wheel testing sites are all outside the city and can be hard for poor city residents to get to.
They need a driver's license to get a job. They can't get a job because they can't get there. Or they get stopped because of a traffic violation on the way to their job without a driver's license, and now they've got a misdemeanor on their arrest record.
Harto says the department is making strides towards reducing the tensions between communities of color and the police department, which persist when people feel like they're being unfairly targeted by police. She recently asked the Justice Department to audit MPD's disciplinary system and is prepared to implement the recommendations. Policy changes are also in the works. The City Council's Public Safety Committee has voted to repeal laws against spitting on the sidewalk and lurking. Supporters of the repeal say the laws are used by police to unfairly target people of color. Minnesota ACLU Executive Director Chuck Samuelson says the pressure from activists, as well as the cooperation from elected and police leaders, can all help eliminate racial disparities.
But we got to be really willing to try. And I have a sense that maybe, just maybe, that's starting.
The City Council will vote on the proposal to repeal laws against lurking and spitting next week. Brant Williams, Minnesota Public Radio News, Minneapolis.
A South Carolina jury has awarded a woman $100 million for damages she says were caused by a Boston Scientific mesh product. Martin Moylan has more.
The transvaginal mesh is used to treat urinary incontinence and other problems. Jurors found Boston Scientific liable for injuries the woman experienced after an implant. The jury determined that Boston Scientific negligently designed and manufactured mesh products and failed to warn doctors and patients of risks. Massachusetts-based Boston Scientific has appealed such awards in the past. The medical device maker, which has extensive operations in Minnesota, has said it vigorously fights the mesh injury cases and claims. But verdicts have been mixed, and a final resolution could be extremely costly. Martin Moylan, Minnesota Public Radio News.
A solar developer has received the final go-ahead to build up to 21 solar generation facilities across the state. Here's Elizabeth Dunbar.
Geronimo Energy's Aurora project had been selected to help Xcel Energy meet peak electricity demand pending final state approval. At 100 megawatts, it will be the state's largest solar project. Geronimo Vice President Betsy Engelking says solar ended up being a good fit for Xcel.
They are looking for reliable supply over their peak days, which tend to be their hottest days of the summer. Their hottest days of the summer also tend to be their sunniest days of the summer. So it aligns very, very nicely with XL's peak load.
When communities in XL's territory are running air conditioners on high, the solar panels will help meet that extra demand for electricity. The project will be up and running by the end of 2016. Elizabeth Dunbar, Minnesota Public Radio News.
The state of Minnesota says it will send layoff notices to nearly 9,500 state employees on Monday because Governor Dayton and legislative leaders have thus far failed to reach a budget deal. Tom Scheck reports.
Minnesota Management and Budget says they are preparing to send layoff notices to 9,451 state workers on Monday. The employees work at 17 different departments, agencies, and boards. The state is sending out the notices on June 1st because some labor contracts require a 30-day notice. However, no state employee will be laid off until July 1st, and that's only if Governor Dayton and legislative leaders fail to reach a budget deal. The governor needs to call a special session because he vetoed three budget bills last week after the legislature adjourned. He vetoed the bills because he says they don't spend enough money on education and his universal pre-K plan. He also isn't happy with policy provisions in the environment, ag, and jobs bills. Tom Scheck, Minnesota Public Radio News.
While we're waiting for the governor and legislative leaders to figure out how and when they will hash out their differences in a special legislative session, the people in Annandale, Minnesota have a particular interest. The legislature agreed in the final hours of its regular session to provide $2 million to help the town of 3,200 people build a fiber optic network to deliver high-speed internet service. But Dayton vetoed the spending. Dave Peters is the head of the NPR News Ground Level Project, and he talked with Steve and John about it last night.
Hasn't the DFL governor been a supporter of rural broadband spending in the past? Why didn't he like this idea?
You're right. Yes, he has been. Dayton has favored spending money to build broadband infrastructure in places where the private market isn't providing it. But first of all, this was part of a larger jobs and energy bill that he vetoed. He had some other objections to it, not related to broadband. But on the broadband portion of the bill, he cited two things he didn't like. One, it called for spending only $10 million, about half what the state put into 17 projects in 2014 to help rural areas get better internet access. And he said that just wasn't enough. But secondly, 20% of that $10 million was earmarked for Annandale. That's something legislators haven't done with broadband spending before, and Dayton said it undermined the competitive process the state established last year to figure out who should get the money.
Let's back up a little. Remind us why the state wants to help build out internet systems when private cable and telephone companies are already in the business.
Yeah, this has been kicked around in state and federal circles for a number of years. The argument is that there are places where private providers simply don't have the market incentive to install high-speed service. And a lot of people argue that leaves big parts of rural America in the dust in the 21st century. They argue that given what education needs and healthcare needs and business needs, high-speed internet access, we should be thinking about that as a utility, much like electricity or telephone service. Mm-hmm. And so there have been a lot of private-public ventures that have tried to get at this, both here and elsewhere around the country.
How invested is Minnesota in expanding broadband?
Last year, the legislature, for the first time, put $20 million into hardware, broadband projects, and the state set up a pretty detailed process to determine who should get that money. Proponents would say that's a drop in the bucket. People talk about it being a $3 billion problem in Minnesota. But at any rate, lots of communities asked for the money that was available, including Annandale. But it wasn't. Annandale was not among the chosen, partly because that area, it's only 50 miles from northwest of Minneapolis in Wright County, it was considered underserved as opposed to unserved, totally unserved. Mm-hmm. And so it lost some points in the competitive process. Everybody seems to agree that Annandale is not well served. It could use better service. The city says that businesses have been forced to leave town because of inadequate service. There have been signs saying no service today because our broadband is down. So the city hired a lobbyist and went to work and got itself included in the legislature, the final legislation this year, something that nobody else did last year or this year.
So basically the governor didn't like lawmakers picking a winner outside the normal process.
Right, exactly.
Then what about the other side of the equation, that this was supposed to be the year of rural Minnesota at the legislature? Yet, as you pointed out, broadband spending for greater Minnesota was cut to $10 million. Do we know why?
Right, yeah. And Dayton is asking for more. He thinks the legislature should kick in more for rural broadband. And I heard a couple of reasons for the relatively small number, the $10 million. One was that last year's projects with a relatively high per connection cost basically maybe spooked some fiscally conservative legislators, and they tightened up the purse strings as a result. The other is that there was pretty strong industry lobbying to the effect that the expensive hardwired fiber networks maybe aren't really needed as much as they used to be because wireless technology is getting better. That's an argument that proponents of spending on this sort of thing reject pretty quickly, or try to pretty quickly. Yes, wireless technology is better, they say, better than it used to be. But if you're running a hospital or a school or a business, you just need something more robust than that. And as they say, fiber is future-proof. Mm-hmm. So in the end, now there are two things to watch for in the special session related to broadband. One, is Annandale going to get to keep its money? And secondly, maybe the larger question is, what will the dollar amount be that's appropriated for broadband spending in rural Minnesota?
All right. Thanks, Dave.
You're welcome.
You can find more reporting from Dave Peters and the Ground Level Project online at mprnews.org.
Sean O'Casey's classic play Juno and the Paycock opens at the Guthrie Theater in Minneapolis tonight. It's the final play in the 20-year tenure of artistic director Joe Dowling, and appropriately enough, he is directing the production. Reporter Ewan Kerr sat down with Dowling to talk about the play and its personal importance to him.
Juno and the Paycock is the story of the Boyles, a Dublin family living in the 1920s through the Irish Civil War. There's Juno, the wife, and her blowhard husband, known as the Captain, who likes to sit in the pub and tell tall tales.
Ah, oh, them was days, Jockster, them was days. Nothing was too hot nor too heavy for me then. Sailing from the Gulf of Mexico to the Antarctic Ocean, I seen things, Jockster, that no mortal man should speak about that knows his catechism.
It's a play dear to Joe Dowling.
Well, it's the play that brought me to America.
Dowling's 1986 production of Juno and the Paycock at the Gate Theatre in Dublin was so successful it launched his international career, ending up on Broadway.
And that got the kind of reviews that one's mother might write. Just incredible. Raves. And began people's interest in me directing in the States. And finally, the invitation to run the Guthrie. So it felt to me at a very appropriate completion of the circle that Juno and the Paycock would be the final play.
Dowling says at one point he decided never to do Juno again, as he'd done it so much. But he says he loves the play, which is about life under terrible poverty and deprivation, but rises above the pain.
And O'Casey has found a way, in a very, very Irish way, of depicting that on stage and not making it depressing. There's a huge amount of humour in the show. There's a real feeling of optimism and hope. Unfortunately, as life did for so many people, that hope is dashed in the end, but it's there.
Juno and the Paycock is the third show in a row Dowling has directed as he wraps up at the Guthrie. He began with Shakespeare's A Midsummer Night's Dream, followed by Arthur Miller's The Crucible.
I think, hopefully not boastfully, The Crucible was among the best things I've done since I came here. I thought we had the perfect cast. Our creative team created an amazing visual treat. It was very hard work because it's a big play with a lot of meat and with a lot of energy required, but it was so satisfying.
Much of Dowling's job over the last 20 years has been looking to the future, arranging seasons and, of course, building the Guthrie's three-theatre complex on the banks of the Mississippi. He's done at the end of June, so he has been able to set aside that administrative work and focus on the plays.
So the joy of actually being engaged with the art, as opposed to having all the other things that go with this job, has actually been wonderful. I've had a great 6 months.
Dowling leaves a real legacy. A new theatre, a thriving company with a series of balanced budgets and a sound national reputation. There have been tough times, raising the money to build, and controversies over the Guthrie's place in the local theatre ecosystem. But Dowling is comfortable with it all.
There's been a lot of talk about the Guthrie in terms of the relationships with other theatres, the relationships with minorities, and they're all valid questions and they all should be asked. But the Guthrie, in my time, has always believed that we as a leader have to both encourage the growth of other companies and help those companies where we can. And the way of doing that in this building has been to invite them in to play their work here.
Speaking of work, Dowling will be busy post-Guthrie. He already has other directing gigs lined up, and he hopes to write a book. He'll be celebrated at a special Guthrie gala called All the World's a Stage on June 6th.
That is Ewan Kerr, who covers the arts for us. Film is considered an art. And Ewan tells us about a new documentary about base jumping. It explores the sanity of the people who parachute off of cliffs, tall buildings, radio masts, and the like.
Sunshine Superman is the story of Carl Banish, an electrical engineer who fell in love with skydiving and then leaping off high structures.
Well, we're kind of used to people calling us crazy, but at least in our opinion, we're not crazy. We're basically fun-loving adventurers.
Director Mara Strauch came to Banish's story through a late uncle. He, too, was a filmmaker and a base jumper who left a collection of movies he'd made of his own jumps. Strauch also found films by Banish, and she wanted to learn more.
He had kind of a Pied Piper kind of inspirational role in these people's lives. You know, he was an iconoclast and a leader and an innovator.
Banish saw himself first and foremost as a filmmaker, as an interview in the film shows.
Interestingly enough, if it weren't for the camera, at least I personally probably wouldn't be that interested in skydiving, because the camera captures something not only for ourselves, but for everybody.
I think his drive was to inspire people to do whatever in their own lives that seeing this activity of base jumping and skydiving could do.
Banish became an aerial photographer, and his expertise strapping heavy 16mm cameras to skydiving helmets got him work in Hollywood. Soon he was applying his skills to the new sport of base jumping, which Strauch said started in part because the gas shortages in the 1970s affected skydiving planes as well as cars.
It was expensive, and they realized that they could jump off of buildings, they could jump off of cliffs, and, you know, this was another way to parachute.
The term base jump is an acronym for buildings, antennas, span, and earth, all launching points for base jumpers. Banish and his friends stress careful preparation and safety procedures. Some of the early jumps were from the top of El Capitan, a towering cliff face in Yosemite National Park. The film captures the jumper's exhilaration, but also the official unease from park rangers who tried to stop it. Mara Strauch says initially there was a legal gray area.
There was no law against base jumping off a cliff because there wasn't base jumping.
The jumps attracted international attention, but the scrutiny prompted the national parks to declare base jumping illegal. The question of legality followed the base jumpers as they began to use high buildings. Strauch said they argued there was no law against what they were doing, only from where they did it.
Buildings, a lot of other objects that base jumpers jump off of, there's no law against it but trespassing. So base jumping itself is not illegal.
Mara Strauch got footage of those early jumps from Jean Banish, Carl's widow. She had a trove of films which sat untouched in her home for 3 decades. As base jumping moved to buildings and towers, it was often Jean who talked to the media. Strauch said the pair complemented each other.
I think it was a beautiful love story, and I don't think I would have made the film if it was just about base jumping. I think it, at the core of this film really is about their relationship.
Carl Banish died in 1984 during a botched jump off a 3,500-foot cliff in Norway called the Troll Wall. His legacy lives on in the sport he championed. Director Mara Strauch says making Sunshine Superman, she also learned a lot from Carl Banish.
I think as a person, it's taught me a lot about what it means to live your life authentically and with purpose.
Strauch says she's interested in base jumpers, but not in trying the sport herself. As a filmmaker, she believes that makes her the perfect person to explain the attraction to people who would never dream of doing it themselves. Ewan Kerr, Minnesota Public Radio News.
That's the NPR News Update podcast for Friday. I'm Phil Picardi. I'll be back with the Minnesota News right here on Monday.